Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 456. We are doing a bunch of shows at SF Sketchfest in February. On February 7th, the Nerdist Podcast goes to the Marines Memorial Theater in San Francisco, and a bunch of tickets are gone, so you should probably hop on those pretty fast if you want to go. And then I'm going to be doing, we're going to screen Revenge of the Nerds, and then the cast is going to be there, and we're going to do a Q&A, I believe it's at the Castro Theater. And I'm doing a bunch of shows that weekend, and the weekend of February 7th, so go to sfsketchfest.com if you plan on being there, and come by. And if you don't want to go to any of my or our shows, then SF Sketchfest has a multitude of other shows that would be of interest to you. So, again, sfsketchfest.com to get tickets, and hopefully we'll see you there. I'd like to thank Inside Lewin Davis for sponsoring this episode of the Nerds. I could just say Lewin Davis sponsored this episode of the Nerds Podcast, and because it's a period piece, he wouldn't really know that he's sponsoring a podcast, even though going on a podcast probably would have helped his music career, but he didn't know about it yet. So it's just one of the many tragedies that the Coen brothers heaped on Lewin Davis, was not giving him a time period in which he could come on a podcast and gain the type of popularity that he so desperately wanted. It's now playing in select cities. It is a young folk singer. It's kind of navigating Greenwich Village in 1961, nominated for 3 Golden Globe Awards, including Best Motion Picture, Comedy or Musical, and written and directed by Joel and Ethan Coen, starring Oscar Isaac and Carey Mulligan and John Goodman and Garrett Hedlund and JT, Justin Timberlake. That's how I say JT now. Even if I'm not referring to Justin Timberlake, that's, you just have to say the letters J and T together. Like JT, which means just tea time. So if you just want tea, it's JT time. Throw that at your mom or kids. Either way, and you'll get the same puzzled looks. But this episode of the podcast is John Lovitz, who I didn't really know before. We had a really, you know, this chat spans a bunch of topics, SNL and Phil Hartman, some really wonderful, wonderful section about Phil and John's relationship with Phil. And then we got into some dad stuff, because I'm still going through that, and I assume we'll probably continue to go through that for a while. So there is some, it is a little dark, a little bit of death talk near the end. So just giving you a heads up. I don't know if that stuff bums you out or not, but this is what I'm going through now. So it's gonna come up from time to time. So, but it was a really comforting and lovely talk. I thought it was a lovely talk. So you know. I hope you enjoy it as well. It is the Nerdist Podcast with John Lovitz, who, by the way, I did his podcast, Lovitz or Leavitz, which should be up now, which we recorded at his theater at CityWalk. So here it is, Nerdist Podcast number 456 with John Lovitz. Or Leavitz. What if I want to put it's right here? Who am I talking to?
Now entering Nerdist.com.
There's no official start. This is it, really.
Oh. And we're done.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'd like to thank John Lovitz for being here.
I had a delightful time.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
It was a good 45 seconds. I think it was a really solid...
I think it was the best 45 seconds.
You know, I've heard of your podcast, so I'm just thrilled to be on it at all. Well, so, goodbye.
Attention spans are very short now. Kids listen like 45 seconds, and then that's it. And they have no time anymore.
Yeah.
It's the ADD, which I have.
Did you just say
You'll
something?
Notice.
I'm sorry. I was looking over there.
What?
What you? Hmm? You go. What you?
Huh?
What? It's really nice to meet you. I feel like we had met once before. Years ago when I used to drink, I would ride shotgun in Bob Saget's car, and then Bob and I would go out and tear it up. And I feel like there were a couple of nights after the Laugh Factory.
I would say it might be the Laugh Factory because I used to do a show there on Wednesdays, and then Bob would come by sometimes after me. So maybe I I apologize. I don't remember.
No, I wasn't saying
you'd
that for you to remember.
I remember because I don't drink.
Oh, you don't either. You don't either. I stopped because of those nights. I stopped because of those crazy nights. It's been like 10 years. Did you ever?
You mean you and Bob got a little intimate?
Yep, that's right. Well, who's to say? We were both really drunk. Anything could have happened. I don't know. But he's a warm, gentle soul, that Bob Saget. Do you still see Bob at all anymore?
Well, we're friends, but I haven't seen him lately. But he's, you know, he's gotten married.
He's gotten the married. He's all married now.
Yeah, to the Hope, who, you know, I met her at the Playboy Mansion years ago. She's a Playmate of the Year, so I think if I was married to the Playmate of the Year, I don't think I'd see my friends.
Did her spread say turnoffs mean
and
people?
And I think they would
Bob
understand.
Saget. Bob Saget and motorcycles, the two things she loves. You're not doing a show. Are you doing any stand up at your theater?
Well, I was, but you know, I do it on the road a lot. So then when I'm here, it's kind of, I don't feel like doing it again because I get bored. So I started, which I think you really started, you know, the podcast, and then I started doing them at my club, and then at my own podcast studio. It's John Lovett's Comedy Club and Podcast Theater, and we have a studio on the second floor. So I started doing my own podcast, but I think you and I guess Mark Maron, and you know, really inspired a lot of people to do it.
Oh, that's awesome to hear.
Well, you would hear about it, and then I'd look it up, and yours is all, you know, number one usually on comedy on iTunes, and then you see Mark, and you see, you know.
Yeah, that really became a good it really became a good outlet for comics because essentially, you know, we kind of needed that. Well, you remember comedy boom. Where it was like there were 50 stand-up specials on every channel at all times. And then that went away for a really long time.
Well, I used to do Woody Allen and Lenny Bruce's routines in my college dorm. And then I thought after I graduated college from UC Irvine, that I want to be a stand-up. So the comedy store was the hottest club in the country. This is like 1979. And across the street where the House of Blues is now, there was nothing but this little shack, and the Comedy Store owned it. So they had a free workshop on Saturday on how to be a stand-up. And the guy that taught it, the first thing he said was, well, you know, if you want to be a stand-up, just get into sitcoms. Don't waste your time. They're not hiring stand-ups for sitcoms. And I said, they're not? And he goes, no, they're not. And then he kept talking, and I raised my hand. He goes, yeah. I go, really? They're not hiring stand-ups for sitcoms? You guys are really funny. You think they would? He goes, yeah, well, you'd think they would, but they don't. And so I thought, oh, gee, well, I guess I'll skip that. I don't want to waste my time, you know. I'll skip that step. And of course, I was 22. I didn't realize they weren't hiring him. Of course, they were hiring. They're hiring everybody for sitcoms. Yeah. They just hired, you know, Robin Williams was huge, you know, from Mork and Mindy that year. You know, that's when he got it. And then, of course, they hired everybody, you know, Roseanne and
Bill Cosby and Seinfeld
Seinfeld, on and on and on. You know, they were looking for those guys to do shows with, and they still do, you know. But I started doing it about 10 years ago because my agent manager, I called him up and I said, listen, I'm not broke, but can you get me some work? I'm going to run out of money in 5 years. And they both said, why don't you sell your house? And I said, well, I have a better idea. I'm going to learn how to do stand-up and fire both of them. And that's what I ended up doing. And then, you know, now I'm in this business, and it's interesting, and I have a great partner, a new partner, Mark Short, and it's interesting. But the thing about stand up, I realized, was everyone for years said you could be a stand up, but I didn't have anything to say. I was just so obsessed with acting, you know. So if you said, what do you want, like on Saturday Night Live, I said to Lorne Michaels once, I said, I think to succeed on the show, you have to have something you want to say about the world, something, you know, I don't care what it is. But and he went, yeah. I go, that's what you need. Even the writers, you know, you have to, you're satir, you know, it's satire, so you have to want to satirize something. And all I wanted to satirize was old movies. I just wanted to be an actor, so that's all I was thinking about. And then, though, after about 20 years, I started getting opinions about everything else and listening to the news more. And you know, so then I had stuff I could talk about. And I think that's with these podcasts, it's the same thing. You have to have like opinions about the world. And I was just so completely focused on acting, and that was it. And I didn't have anything to say about anything, really.
Well, did you?
I mean, I just was obsessed with that, and that was it.
So you skipped the stand up track at the Comedy Store in 1979. That would have been an amazing time to be there, because then you've got like Richard Pryor going through there, and then a couple years later you have Kinison going through there, and and Robin, and all these amazing, like when the main room was probably just explosive.
Or wasn't it just the hottest comedy club in the country. It was like the hottest club in the country. There was Studio 54 in New York, and there was the Comedy Store in L.A. I mean, it was like packed. Like on a Monday night, they had an improv potluck night. So I went to that for 3 weeks. And then the third week, I was waiting in line. And I'm like fifth in line. And a guy said, oh, we're asking certain people not to come back, and you're one of them.
Oh, whoa. Shit.
Yeah. And my face just dropped. My heart just sank, you know. And I'm so, you know, proud to say that I've never seen that guy work. And then the next week's when I went to the stand-up workshop.
Well, did you find sketch then? Did you start doing sketch comedy? Like, what was the path from there to SNL?
I didn't know anything. I didn't know what to do. And a friend of mine who graduated about, you know, I was in the quarter system at Irvine. So he graduated a quarter before me. So I said, what do we do now? Because it was all theater at Irvine. He said, well, you know, Los Angeles, everything's filmed. So I'm taking a class for acting on the camera. So I think, he goes, that's what I think we should do. I went, okay, I don't know. So I went to this place called the Film Actors Workshop, where he was, and this guy, Tony Barr, ran it, who was great. And I did that for a year and a half, and it is a lot to learn. It basically, you have to pull it way back from stage, because when you're on stage, you know, you're in a big room, and there's no microphone, so everybody has to hear you, but you can't, like, you know, yell. Because then it looks like you're yelling, and you can't burp like that either. And so you have to learn to use your voice, you know, and project it and make it, you know, you have to hold the audience's attention, you know, but, you know, like a stand-up, but you're in a play. Whereas a movie, you know, they go, the audience is like, you know, a foot away from you. The camera's right there. The mic is, the base of is on your shirt. You know, they can hear you. So it's the art of a subtlety, you know, and also the camera, it picks up everything that you're thinking. So if your focus wavers in a scene, the camera picks it up. It picks up everything. So it picks up everything true, and it picks up everything false. You know what I mean? So it's really tricky. It's very subtle, and it's really hard to do, and harder. You know, a lot of stage actors, oh, no, stage is much harder. I'm like, no, it isn't. This thing is so subtle. Every little thing you do, the audience reads into it. Everything. You know, so what I learned was basically you don't do anything. And then unless it means something, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to trying to, you can't control everything either. All your tension's on the other person. And when you're acting, and that way you're just kind of letting it go, and the camera will pick stuff up, you know. And I remember there's a documentary on YouTube I was watching about Marilyn Monroe. It's called, The Last Days of Marilyn Monroe. It's about her movie. It was called Something's Gotta Give. And they ended up, you know, scrapping the whole project. I haven't finished watching it, but they show scenes of her from the movie that never got made, but they show some of the footage, you know, and you watch her, and she's just like brilliant. Like, I watch it and I go, well, no wonder she was like the biggest star, because she's just, you either have a presence on film or you don't, you know, and it's very subtle. And there's a scene where, it's funny, I was just listening to the radio. It's an old, my favorite wife. It was a Cary Grant, I think, movie. His wife's on an island for 7 years, and he thinks she's dead, so he gets remarried, and then his wife shows up the day he comes home, right? So that's what this movie is going to be, a remake of that. And I think they made it again with Doris Day and Rock Hudson.
And Castaway.
Well, Castaway, kind of, yeah. Like, that's what I was thinking, like a serious version.
Yeah.
But anyway, so they show the scene where she first comes home, and she hasn't seen her. In this movie, it's like she's gone 5 years, and she sees her two kids that she hasn't seen in 5 years. And they were like, you know, 2 and 3, and now they're like 8 and 7. So It's just the camera on her, and she's looking at her kids for the first time in 5 years. And it's just, she's unbelievably, like, if you're, this is an actress, you know, not a sex symbol, an actress. She's unbelievably fantastic, like better than anybody I've ever seen. It's crazy. She's good as Meryl Streep as an actress. She's unbelievably great.
Is that, can you learn that, or do you think she just has that, she just sort of had those skills in her brain?
No, she was studying acting and everything, but I think she had a talent for it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, she was very open and very vulnerable. So, but then it said she was going to the actor's studio. So you learn how to be effective in certain ways. And it, basically, Alan Bates is a, you know, great English actor, and he said movies photograph thought. Meaning, you know, when you're on film, like a close-up, right, all they see your face. And they see your eyes. Your eye, and you ever heard that expression, your eyes are the window to your soul?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what it is. So your eyes are the only part of your brain that's visible. So if you think it, you see it in somebody's eyes, you know. And the camera picks it up or it doesn't. But for some reason, the camera with her picked up everything she's feeling. And, you know, I don't know how you do that. It just does or it doesn't. But for example, like an actor on a stage, you know, they go, you have to develop your voice. And when the point of your voice is that whatever you're feeling, your voice can express it. And so you can learn how to do that. And some people can do it and some can't. Or some learn how to do it, you know.
Yeah. So, but something, but like something like SNL is basically like, is essentially like live. It's like a, it's that sort of weird hybridized, like, well, it's like theater comedy, but it's televised, so there's,
right,
you still get close-ups and stuff, but it's, but you're still playing to that audience there. It's just a kind of,
right,
this weird hybridized,
it's a combination
version
of everything. And I loved it because it's live and the audience is there. But I figured it out. I go, exactly what you're saying is, how do I play it? Because you're on stage live and there's this really high energy and the audience is there and you have one shot at every scene, but at the same time you're on camera. So I thought, all right, you play, I play to the audience that's there through the camera. So it's a combination, you know. So you have to have energy, but if you're too, I mean, I try, a lot of my characters, you know, they're bigger than life. I like that, but they're also real. I try to do both, you know, like really funny and also do the best acting I can.
How long did it take you to figure out the mechanism of that show when you were there?
Well, I figured it out pretty quick, but not, you know, I got better the more shows I did, you know what I mean? And then, you know, I learned things like, you know, there would be like, say, three cameras, right? And there's three walls, and then, the, you know, you call it the fourth wall, it's not there. And Lauren would just block it. He goes, face out, face out, face out, you know, don't, as much as you can. So, You would, because that, and that's, they have cue cards, you know, and they would make changes up to the last minute. So I would, when the first show I did, I thought I could look at the card really quick and then look back at the person and the camera wouldn't notice, but it was an idiot. You see my eyes darting, and I thought, oh, I thought I could, you know, do it fast enough. And Penny Marshall was hanging around the first show, and she befriended me, and she called me up. She goes, learn your lines. I go, what do you mean? Can you see me reading the cards? She goes, yes. She goes, I can tell you're reading the cards. I'm like, oh, I didn't think you could see that. And I watched, and I saw my eyes darting. So if they held the, like, if you're talking to camera, like on Weekend Update, you know, do my liar character, and they held the cards right underneath the lens, it didn't look like, it looked like you were looking in the lens even if you're looking at the card. So those I would know well, but the other stuff I would try to memorize. But the other thing was, there's three cameras, and you knew when you're, which camera was on, because there's a red light on top of the camera. So what I learned to do was I knew when the camera was on me and when it wasn't. So mm-hmm. I would, like, somebody would say something, and then I'd wait for my camera to go on and time it off that. And that's a little tricky, but it's fun to do. You wait, and then you give it a look, and go, ba-boom. Otherwise, the joke is missed, you know?
Well, if
so there's technical stuff that you have to do while you're doing the sketch.
If you wanted to go into, you know, if your drive was to be an actor, was there any hesitation to go after SNL? Like, did you go, oh, maybe I should just do film and do, like, really, you know?
No, I never thought about being on that show. I finally, I did the Film Actors Workshop. I went to New York for a year, did like the Renaissance Fair, and then did this off Broadway play, Lady Windermere's Fan, and this, you know, theater called the Nameless Theater. That's how off Broadway it was. It didn't even have the name was Nameless. I think it was 88 seats. And then I have a cousin, Bob Lovitz, who went to Juilliard. He's my age. And he wasn't getting work. I said, what do you think? Should I go back to Los Angeles? He said, well, John, you're not even in Actors Equity. How can you audition? He goes, I'm in the union, and I'm having trouble getting work. And he was in Juilliard, and John Houseman is his acting company, you know, and he was a great actor. So I thought, you know, I'll go back to LA and I'll start the Groundlings. And I had nothing in New York. In LA, my friend's dad said, he's a doctor. And he goes, I have a patient that's an agent. And then I used to work at this clothing store, and the secretary said, oh, my husband has a lawyer that could help get you in SAG. So I go, well, that's better than nothing. I had nothing in New York. And I met the agent, nothing happened, and I got the SAG thing worked out like 2 years later as an extra. But I started going to the Groundlings. So I stayed with my friend David, who's Lisa Kudrow's older brother. Mm-hmm. I grew up with their family. So I was in Woodland Hills. So I go, I'm going to go to the Groundlings. And I knew about it for 5 years, but I was like too afraid. I want to be a comedian like Woody Allen, you know. And I'm like driving from Woodland Hills to the Groundlings Theater, which is on Melrose and, you know, near Poinsettia. And I was like crying. Like sobbing. I was so scared. But I get to the class and I get on stage and do something, and they go, and the teacher goes, Randy Bennett from Texas, he goes, well, that's funny, but you could have done like this, you could have done like this, you can be funny this way, you can be funny that way. And I was like, oh my God, this is like heaven. Because, you know, they always say, stop goofing off, you know, and here they're going, you could goof off this way, you could goof off this way, you might want to think. It's like school for class clown. And yeah. I was a class clown. And I'm like, oh, this is heaven. So I was in that, and then I did the class over, it was spread out over a year, and I got in the Sunday company there, and I was in that for a year and a half, and then I got voted in the main company, and then I, in September of 84, and then everything just happened really fast. In January of 85, we had a new show at the Groundlings. I was doing my liar character. We got good reviews in the Hollywood Reporter, so Jim McCauley, he booked The Tonight Show, and he's the one that found all these comedians and gave them their break on The Tonight Show. And, like, you know, Roseanne and Gary Shandling and Bill Maher and everybody. Jerry, Seinfeld. So, well, anyway, it's like March, third week of March, and I get a call, all these calls on my answering machine saying, oh, congratulations, John, that's so great, from the Groundlings. I don't know what they're talking about on a Sunday. So on Monday, I called the Tom Maxwell's artistic director. I said, what's going on? Everyone's congratulating me. You know, for what? And he goes, we're going on The Tonight Show. I said, who? He goes, you and Tim Stack and Don Witter and you're doing two sketches.
Oh, I know, yeah.
Sketches.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, and I said, when? He goes, Thursday. I go, Thursday? And we're both screaming. We're so excited, you know. And I'm like, Thursday? You know, and you're doing your liar character and you're doing a piece with Tim Stack.
And I want people to understand, just for younger people, like, to get a call in 1985 saying you're going to do comedy on The Tonight Show is huge.
Huge. It's your big break.
20 million people watch that show. Like, it was fucking huge. Like, you couldn't – that was the dream. That was the dream to get on that
right.
show.
When I was in Tony Barr's class, you know, in 79, we'd all talk about what are you going to do when you make it? What are you going to say in The Tonight Show? Like, that was the big break. And I go – and I just got in the company. And I go, what? Me, I was in like two out of the three sketches, you know. And like Phil Hartman had been in there for years, and I felt bad. I'm like, well, Phil's like the king of the Groundlings. And I felt kind of weird, you know, because I thought, I remember saying to my dad, I feel kind of bad because these people have been in it for years, and I just got in, you know. And my dad goes, you're too nice, you know. So, but we did it, and that got me an agent. And then he suggested Saturday Night Live. I said, oh, shut up. He goes, no, I'm serious. I said, you know what? I have a better idea. Why don't I land on Pluto? Why don't I do that? He goes, no, but I'm serious. I'm going to submit you. I go, all right, just shut up already. I don't want to hear about it. I just thought it was the most ridiculous thing ever. Because to me, it was a whole nother world where those people that lived in showbiz land and, you know, it was just another world. But Lorraine Newman had seen me in the show in the Groundlings in the summer, and she befriended me. So she recommended me to Lorne Michaels, and then Mike Eisen's dad, he submitted my tape, and then I got a move, and he got me auditions. And I said, get me extra work on soap, because that paid like $90 a day. And at the time, I was making $45, you know, $5 an hour. He goes, you don't want to do that, but He goes, think about it. If you really want me to do that, I will. So the next, he goes, but there'll be auditions coming up in 3 weeks. So the next day I called him. I said, okay, I'll wait. So he got sent me on all these auditions. I got everything I auditioned for. I had to turn down Divorce Court. And I got a recurring role in a series and a movie in the same day. And I got a movie with Charles Grodin.
Jesus.
And we shot on, yeah, I couldn't believe it.
What
so
movie?
All suddenly, it's called Last Resort.
Uh-huh.
And we shot on a Catalina. And then I'd met, this is how silly Showbiz was. So I got in the Tonight Show, right? So Jim McCauley recommended me to Fred Weissman, who was in charge of casting Saturday Night Live out of Los Angeles. And Fred was a dentist. And I met him. He goes, I don't know anything about show business. So I asked Jim, you know, who's good? And he said, John Lovett's the best sketch comedian in Los Angeles. And I said, he said that? I go, but what about Phil Hartman and Tim Stack and all, you know? I go, well, that's flattering. I don't think so, but all right. And then he had me meet Franken and Davis, who were producing the show.
Yeah.
And then I was supposed to meet Lauren, but I was on Catalina. So Charles Grodin on his own called Lauren and said, hey, can you see him Friday, you know?
Oh, my God.
Jeez.
Yeah, because he kept wanting to stick me in the movie. I only supposed to have one scene, but he liked me. He goes, let's put him in more and more.
So what do you think that was? So basically, there's some sort of a magical thing that's happening around you.
Everything lined up like perfect.
Where you weren't really focused. I mean, you were trying to do this thing. You were trying to do comedy. But all these external things sort of came together.
Well, I went to the Groundlings because my same friend, Mike Sabatino, said, you know, you should learn to act on camera. We went to college together. Then he got an agent. Mike, how did you get an agent? It's like impossible. Well, John, I got in a play and I got on stage and they saw me. He goes, you got to be seen. So I went, all right. So I thought, well, there was like 250 theater companies in L.A. at the time. It was huge.
Oh, my God. That seems weird thinking about how L.A. is now.
Yeah, there was, well, how many are there? I don't know how many there
are. I don't think there's that many.
There was a ton. All off Equity Waiver theaters. But yeah. Like 250, it exploded. And it was very competitive. You know, you audition, maybe you get in, maybe you didn't. But I thought, well, the Groundlings, I want to do that. And they have a school. They have like climbing the ladder. So at least you have a shot. So my thought was, I'll go through the school, I'll get in the company, I'll get on stage, I'll get seen and get an agent and get work. But Saturday Night Live never entered my mind, ever. It was just like, no, it was like landing on Pluto. I said, what are you, it was my agent, he kept mentioning, I go, well, you just shut up already. You're ridiculous, you know. Yeah, they're going to cast me, you know. But then everyone kept saying yes, and then Lauren Michaels, Charles Grodin recommended him in his own. Lorraine Newman recommended me, so Lauren wanted to meet me. And I met him. I remember my agent said, we drove up from San Pedro, you know, taking the ferry across to the Beverly Hills Hotel. Right when we stopped, Michael Caine walked in front. I'm like, the car. And I went, this is that world I've heard about, you know? And then I met Lauren. He talked for a long time. And he goes, how old are you? I said, 28. And he goes, oh, Billy Murray was 28. And I thought, do I have the job? And then later on, Lauren said, didn't you know when I said that you had the job? I thought, well, I thought maybe, but it was, you know, I thought, no, I'm crazy, you know.
Did you audition for him at all, or just off the tape in
a
the
little
meeting?
Bit? And then, no, I just met him then. And then they flew us to New York. From Los Angeles. But the thing was, it was in all the newspapers. Lauren Michaels is coming back to Saturday Night Live. So they had auditions, you know, in Canada, New York, LA, Chicago, everywhere. So they flew six of us from Los Angeles, three men and three women. I didn't know any of them. So the three women were Jennifer Tilly.
Oh, wow.
And Pam Madison. You know Pam?
No.
She's a great stand-up, great impressionist. She didn't get the show. She should have got it. She's terrific. I was like, I couldn't believe she didn't get it. It was ridiculous. And Julie Brown. But oh. not downtown Julie
Brown. No, Julie Brown, like redhead Julie Brown.
The prom girl's got a gun.
Yeah. Earth Girls Are Easy, Julie Brown.
Yeah. And then the guys were myself, Dennis Miller, and Damon Wayans.
Jeez.
But we were all completely unknown. So we fly there, and then there's this huge Minskoff Theater in New York, and there's this huge rehearsal hall. And they say they're going to cast, there's spots for five men and five women, and there's 10 finalists, 10 men, 10 women. It's like the Miss America contest. I mean, it was in all the papers. It was like huge. And Then we get there and they go, oh, one guy didn't show up. So there's nine men. There's five slots. Then you find out slowly they cast a guy named Terry Sweeney. They cast Randy Quaid.
Yeah.
They already cast Robert Downey Jr. And they already cast Anthony Michael Hall.
Oh, that was that season.
Yeah. So then they go, there's one spot open for not out of the nine of you. And so I remember we're waiting outside, and Damon Wayans is going, you know, if I get it, I get it. I don't care. He goes in. He comes out 15 minutes later, drained, sweating. His eyes are glossed over. I'm like, what happened to him, you know? He just looked like, you know, like he just blew it. I go in. I do my characters, and Lauren says, do you have anything else? I said, well... And I thought, yeah, I just started writing a little stand-up routine that I was doing at the Groundlings, but Fred Weissman said, you know, was casting Annabelle. He said, I go, do you think I should do that? He goes, no, because you're competing against other professional stand-ups, like Dennis Miller, mm-hmm. right? So I said, okay. But then Lauren's asking for more. So I thought, well, I better do it. So I started doing it, and nobody's laughing. And then I thought, just finish to the end. So I finished. No one laughed. They were laughing a little bit. And before we went in, they said, you know, don't worry. Nobody, they don't laugh much. Don't worry about it. But when I was doing my characters, they were laughing, like half of them. So I thought, well, this is good. They're laughing. And then I did that, and then I just was like, this is a disaster. And I left the room, and I was just like Damon, sweating. My eyes are glossed over. I go, I just blew the biggest chance of my life. And Pam Madison says, you know, John, I'm going to go across the street to a St. Patrick's Cathedral to light a candle, you know, and pray that I get the show. Do you want to go with me? And I'm thinking, well, I'm Jewish. I'm like, yes, I'll go. I go, I don't care anything. And I'm in there lighting a candle. I go, Jesus, if you give me the show, I'll say you're the son of God. The next day, they put us on tape. And then...
Can I just back you up before you say anything? Yeah. How did Dennis Miller do?
Well, that's the thing. The next day, I'm usually... late. I wasn't today for your show. So they go, be there 4:30. So I get there like 4:20 and I'm waiting to audition. And I waited for 4 hours before I finally, you know, and so I'm watching, I liked Humphrey Bogart and that's on TV. So I'm watching that. I'm so nervous for an hour. So I go, okay, this will help me relax. So I'm watching that. I'm waiting. And I start getting sleepy. You know, and you're just waiting and waiting, you know. And then finally I went into the control booth and I see Dennis Miller on camera. And he's being very loose and very funny. So I thought, oh, I'll be like that. So finally they call me in. And before I went in, I saw Randy Quaid, who I'd met once before. And I said, hey, I have this bit I did at the Groundlings about a soldier in World War II, how he ended up there. And there was a piece I did with Tim Stack. And Tim is 6'4", and so is Randy. But the point, Tim did it on his own. And then when I got in the Groundlings, I said, hey, can I be in that piece with you? So we wrote a piece together. Tim was always great to me. So I go in the room, and Lauren goes, do you want to do The Liar again? I go, well, I kind of already did. He goes, yeah, that's true. And I'm talking, and then he goes, Randy, go up next to John. So Randy's standing next to me and stuff. And he goes, what do you want to do? I go, I don't know. I don't really have anything else. And then Randy goes, why don't you tell me that thing about your grandmother, which was, you know, how I ended up in the war and my grandmother took my place, you know. And it was very silly. So at one point, Randy's supposed to be a captain. I go, well, you see, captain. And I looked up at Randy, and in my mind, I thought, I kind of did a double take. Like I looked up at him, and then I kind of jerked my head. I went, oh. Because I didn't say, oh, but I went, I looked, like my mouth dropped open. I looked up at him. I thought, oh, that's funny that he's on my left, and he's 6'4". Just like Tim. So I'm looking in the exact same spot, you know, way up high. And I bring that up because, and then they sent us home, and I thought, there's no way I got the show. I'm a 1 out of 9. They're going to pick me. And that, so I went home like on a Sunday, and I started thinking, all right, I'm going to write more stuff for the Growlings. I'm going to start trying to do stand-up, you know. And on Thursday, I get a call, and Lorraine Newman goes, you got it. And I go, I did? I go, you're kidding. She goes, you got it. And then she goes, and you overcame a lot. And I said, oh, because I'm Jewish, right? Yeah. And she said, yep. They went, okay. And then I called the producer and I said, Dynamite, this girl. And I said, well, I said I got the show. And they go, oh, she shouldn't have told you that. We don't know yet. I'm like, what? And they're always like that on SNL. They never like told you. They always kept you kind of in the dark about everything. So I called Charles Grodin and I said, Lorraine Newman just called me. And I go, can I ask you a favor? He goes, yeah, sure. And he was like a mentor to me. He was really nice to me and great to me. I was 28 and he was like, you know, 40-something or 52 or so. I said, listen, Lorraine Newman just called me and said I got the show. And I called the producer and they said I don't have it. I go, can you find out for me if I have the show or not? I go, I'm like dying to... He goes, yeah, okay. He goes, okay, I'll call you right back. So 5 minutes later, he calls me and goes, you got it.
Oh, that's awesome.
I go, I did? He goes, yeah. And I went, oh, my God. And I drove down to the Groundlings Theater, and my teacher, Randy Bennett, was my main teacher there. Phyllis Katz taught me song, but Randy was my main teacher. Song improv, Phyllis taught it. But he's teaching class. I go, Randy. He goes, what? I go, I got it. He goes, what? I go, I got Saturday Night Live. He goes, you got it? I go, I got it. And he started, he goes, oh, my God. He starts crying, like sobbing. You got it. You got it. You know, it was such a huge emotional thing, you know. Because I had one job before, and I was 25 for 2 weeks on the paper chase. That was it. Now I'm 28, you know. And I just, you know, and I got it. And now I'm here.
And then some other things happened, and then here you are.
Yeah.
But that was the season. So that was the Randy, Randy Quaid, Robert Downey Jr. season. Was that post that one season with Billy Crystal and Christopher Guest and Harry Shearer?
Yeah, right after that.
Right after that. So then they basically did.
They were 84, 85, and then this was 85, 86.
And then they pretty much purged everyone else but you. Right.
Well, they kept myself and Dennis Miller and Nora Dunn. But you know what happened was we did the shows and then like the second show I did my liar character. And then the next week, Robert Smigel did his Triumph the Dog. It was his first year working. He said, John, some electrician came up to Lauren's office and said that liar thing is the funniest thing I've seen in this show in years or something like that. So Lauren went, oh. So then he put me together with A. Whitney Brown, who was a great comic.
Yeah, of course.
And then Whitney and I would write it together. And I would thank God, because I didn't know what to do with it after the first time I did it. I didn't have anything. And I really learned how to write comedy and jokes from Whitney, and we were a great team. And After that, I really give the credit 50-50, because we wrote it together, you know. And then we'd had a lot of good shows, and the whole country's imitating The Liar. And then everyone was coming together, and so I remember TV Guide. We'd already done 11 shows, but the review in TV Guide reviewed like the first three. Didn't mention that my character now is a huge hit. Didn't mention anything good, you know, and really slammed it. So the last show was hosted by Angelica Houston, who, it's funny, I just saw her. She just wrote a book about her life. It's funny. I hadn't seen her. Anyway... They had a book party. I just saw her like last week. So she hosted, and then they had Billy Martin, the, you know, baseball player and Yankees manager as a guest star. So they wrote a sketch at the end of the show where Billy's mad that wasn't in the show more. So, you know, and he was known for a bad temper, and he was the sweetest guy. He was so nice, but I know he got in a lot of fights, but he couldn't have been sweeter. So anyway, they wrote a sketch. They go, let's write a sketch. Billy's mad that he's not in the show as much, so he decides to burn down the studio. So they did the sketch, and like there's a big fire, and then you watch it, and you go, Lauren says to the writer, she goes, here, wait for me in the writer's room where the fire is. And then he goes, no, John, go to my limo. Right. And then they rolled the credits, and they had a question mark after everybody's name.
I remember that.
Yeah, it was pretty, and a lot of people were pissed. But I didn't even know if I was coming back to the show. They didn't tell us anything. And I remember that summer, I said, Lauren, am I coming back? He goes, well, yeah, of course. I go, well, I don't know. No one told me anything. I have no idea. Nothing, you know. It was always like that. You go, are you coming back? And you fight. You just, they always kind of kept you on edge, you know, the whole time. You never knew if you had your job or not.
It sounds like you're one of those people that everyone wants to help and be nice to. What would you attribute that to? Are you just in general, are you, you know, seem like a nice guy. Did you think that's what it is? Like, oh, we really like John. He's a sweet guy.
Well, I mean, that was like the last seven. After college, I had one job for 2 weeks. So it wasn't like everyone was helping me. I'm nice, but I think they thought I was really funny.
Yeah.
But and you know, they are like, oh, you have it. You have that thing. Me personally, I didn't know if I did. I just thought, am I professional yet? Am I professional actor yet? That's how I was always thinking. So I was always just trying to get better. And wanting to be funny and hoping that I was. But I didn't know if I had the talent. I didn't know. You know, I remember the very first sketch, and that I was on, and it was kind of like a talk show format, and Terry Sweeney spoke first, and Denitra Vance and Nora Dunn, and I think Joan, and I'm going, God, in my mind, I go, they look so confident. I'm so nervous, you know, and you can see it. I'm like going, well, I was so nervous, you know, and I remember thinking, you know what, I'll find out if I have it or I don't. We went on the ninth floor. They had these this glass case, and the ninth floor is where the bleachers are. The studio's on the eighth floor, but it's the eighth and ninth floor, and then the bleacher seats are, you know, the rafters are on the ninth floor. So you'd walk into this down the hallway from the elevators, and then you walk in to where the seats are, and on the right there was this glass case, and in the case was John on a mannequin was John Belushi's bee costume, and next to him there was a Eddie Murphy's Gumby costume, like a life with a life mask of Eddie Murphy, so it looked like Eddie frozen in the case. And I remember looking at that, going, "What am I gonna do? I mean, I can't be Eddie Murphy or John Belushi. They're huge stars. Like, what am I gonna do?" And I just thought, well, I'll just be funny the way I'm funny. And even the first thing I wrote on the show, which Lauren, I thought was funny, but Lauren wouldn't let me do it, was like an update. I go, "Hi, I'm John Lovitz," which means what? Nothing. And that's my point. Who am I? Why did he hire me? I mean, the guy that hired John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd and Gilda Radner, now he hires me? I go, what, is he lost it? I think he's crazy. I don't get it. I mean, I'm here. And then you hear Lauren in the loudspeaker, "All right, John, that's enough." I go, "No, but seriously," I go, "have you just gone nuts? I mean, me? I mean, who am I?" And "All right, cut his mic." "No, wait." You know, and then they cut the mic, and then you hear, like, "Live from New York, it's Saturday night." And it was very self-deprecating, but he didn't want to. I guess he didn't like it because he, you know, I was saying, like, "Why did you hire me? What are you thinking?" You know.
Right.
And let me tell you something. Diana Minot, who I love, is a producer in the show, a great friend. She says to me, "John, here's who we think's going to make it the first season after they cast everybody." She says, "It'll be Robert Downey, Joan Cusack, Randy Quaid, Denitra, and probably Terry Sweeney and Nora." And I'm just looking. I'm like, "Oh, thanks. Okay."
Well, because Terry Sweeney was...
didn't mention me to me. I go, "You're the producer of the show. You're saying you don't expect me to make it, you know."
Terry Sweeney was
last guy they expected to break through. They did not expect that.
Terry Sweeney did really broad, like, he did Nancy Reagan, and he did really big characters.
And he's very funny.
Yeah.
I thought they all did well. I mean, I thought as the season went on, I thought the cast, you know, we didn't know each other. Robert and Anthony Michael Hall were friends, but I didn't know anybody. I met Randy once. I didn't know anybody. We didn't know each other. But I thought we really came together. I was sad that they weren't back. It was weird my second year. I knew Phil and Nora and Dennis, but I didn't know the rest of them. And I was just like, this is just weird. Like, where are they? You know, it's going back to work and everybody's new. And you're like, yeah.
What's that same feeling? Was it the same feeling you had when you got on The Tonight Show? And you're like, what? But what about everyone else?
Well, I felt bad that, I mean, I was thrilled to be on it. But, you know, I'd just gotten into the company. You know, and then I got Saturday Night Live, and Paul Rubens, you know, Pee Wee Herman.
Yeah, of course,
you know,
Paul, yeah.
He'd been in the Groundlings, and I remember he came up to me, and after I got Saturday Night Live, he goes, "My God," he goes, "I've never seen it happen this fast for anybody."
Wow.
Yeah, I go, "Yeah, but it's 13 years since I was 15 doing plays in school, and I just kept going." I mean, it didn't seem fast to me. Being in the Groundlings, it was fast, though, he meant.
Right.
I just got in the company in September, and a year later, I'm on SNL. I mean, it was just, and the only... Before that, they'd cast, you know, Lorraine Newman from the Groundlings. And Tom Maxwell, he's very funny. He goes, "Boy, it's just like clockwork here at the Groundlings. Every 10 years, somebody gets that."
And then for a while, it was pretty much like, go on the Groundlings and then get on SNL. That was kind of it was sort of like the feeder of, you know, then the Chris Kattan.
Well, it became, I got it, you know, because Lauren had left for 5 years and come back. And he would go to the Groundlings to look for talent, you know. And then, so they kept Nora and Dennis Miller and myself. And then they said, "Who do you work well with?" So I recommended Phil Hartman and Tim Stack and Lynn Stewart, who is Miss Yvonne and Pee Wee Herman, and Tress McNeil, who's like, does a lot of voice on the...
Tress.
And those four were the best at the Groundlings. That's who I looked up to. Everybody looked up to them. And they ended up casting, you know, Phil. And And then that was that cast for 8 years or 4 years. Then they brought in Mike Myers last year and a half. But that's why we did well, because there was only eight of us. It was myself, the men, me, Dennis, Dana Carvey, and Kevin Nealon. Wait, Kevin Nealon, Dana Carvey, Phil Hartman, Dennis Miller, myself, the five men, and the woman Nora Dunn, and then Jen Hooks and Victoria Jackson. So we were the eight main people. There's just eight, like there was in the original 5 years, for like 4 years. So we, and then they had A. Whitney Brown and Al Franken as feature players, and that was it. So
Senator
we got to
Al
do
Franken?
Yeah, now he's a senator. Yeah. Right. Amazing.
I mean, I always look at that, I think back, and I think... there's something. The thing about Phil Hartman wasn't just how amazing he was, not his character work, but he just seemed like a guy you wanted to just be around a lot.
He was. He was. He was the nicest guy in the world. And what happened in 1984 was they had the Olympics in Los Angeles. So they had a thing called the Olympics Arts Festivals, and they funded, you know, a lot of arts projects, and they funded 9. Equity Waiver Theaters to do an original show, and they gave you money to produce a show. So the Groundlings was one of the 9 theaters they picked, and then the Groundlings decided they were going to do a show based on a character Phil Hartman did called Chick Hazard, which was a spoof of like a, you know, Humphrey Bogart detective from the 40s and that kind of thing. So they did the show, and then I got asked to I'd been in the Sunday Company a year, and then You after 6 months, you can vote in the main company. I didn't get in the first 6 months. And then the second 6 months, you know, it was a year. And I still didn't get in. And I kind of felt like, you know, some of the people got in. I think I'm better than. But so Tom Maxwell said, well, you know, he goes, you had problems with so-and-so. I don't want to say who, and so-and-so. And I'm like, well, I go, they're mentally ill. I go, everyone has problems with them. I go, I just happen to be the first. I go, they're nuts. You know, I go, I'm sorry. I don't get along with nuts. I go, I don't get along with people who are mentally ill. I just don't. They seek me out, and I just fight with them. And everyone, after me, everyone had problems with them, like everybody. So he said, well, why don't you understudy this part and in the Chick Hazard, and because so-and-so wants some time off, so we got to get an understudy. So why don't you do that? And he goes, I'm the artistic director. I've never worked with you. I really don't know you. So why don't we... he goes, if you're going to be in the company, you're going to be working with me. So why don't we see how we work together? You could understudy this part, and we'll see how we work together and see how it goes. Does that sound fair? I said, yes. I go, that sounds more than fair. I go, that sounds great. That's great. That's perfectly fair. Let's do that. So I understudied this part. Oh, and I said, by the way, what made you pick me anyway to understudy the part? He goes, well, it was Phil's idea. I go, Phil knows who I am? Because Phil was like this giant star at the Groundlings. Like, nobody had money. He had a house. He had a car. Yeah. He had a real job, a new car, you know, a great car. New, you know, we didn't have a dime. And I remember he, in the Groundlings, he's walking down this hallway where these lockers are. And I'd never met him, you know. Never spoken to him, never met him. So I said, I go, oh, hey, Phil. I go, I'm, and he was in costume and he looked like a movie star, you know. In this trench coat and the hat and makeup. I go, oh, hey, Phil, I'm John Love. He goes, yeah, I know who you are, John. I go, you do? He goes, yeah, I've seen your work. I think you're great. I go, well, thanks for recommending me to understudy the part. He goes, oh, yeah, you'll be fantastic. And he walked on by. And in my head, I thought, oh, my God, Phil Hartman spoke to me. I mean, that's how big he was. And he was 9 years older. And I just, so from that moment on, you know, I just like going, he's the best. So he was like 9 years older. So he was like the big brother. I had all sisters. And David was like my brother, but I always wanted a big brother. So he became that to me. And I was just idolizing him. I go, Phil, like a puppy dog. You're the best. You're the, you know. So imagine you got this guy who's like just says, you're the shit. You're the king. You know, you're like, oh. So one day he goes, hey, do you want to come to my house? I go, yeah. Oh, I kept saying, I want to see your house, Phil. So I went over. He goes, you know, you're the first person from the Groundlings I've ever had to my house. I go, I am? I go, why? He goes, well, you know, I don't know. I'm just very private. I don't have people over. And so we became like brothers, you know, and really, really close, you know. So, of course, when he died, it was just like the worst thing ever. But he's just the nicest guy in the world. And he could imitate anybody. He's a real genius. His brother was a music manager. So his brother said, You know the group America?
He did the album cover.
Yeah.
He did
so his brother managed America. So he goes, hey, can you draw an album cover? We're going to do like the best of America. And I asked his brother, he goes, I go, was it amazing? He goes, yes. I said, Phil, draw something. So Phil, he goes, he shows me, his brother John goes, he shows me this thing. He goes, you mean something like this? And John said, he said, something like this. Exactly this. Are you kidding? And he became like a graphic artist. That's how he made money. And he the logo for Crosby, Stills, and Nash, he designed that.
Oh, man.
I mean, he did everything.
So he was set already. Like,
yeah, then he got in the Groundlings. I said, how did he end up in the Groundlings? And they tell the story about someone was having a birthday party. So they went to the Groundlings, and Phil was celebrating somebody's birthday, a group of friends. They went to the Groundlings, watched the show, then there was an intermission. And they're backstage, and they said, we hear everybody in the audience laughing. And we go, what's everyone laughing at? Where there's an intermission, no one's on stage. And they said, we walked out, and there's Phil on stage, like entertaining everybody. And he was really funny. They go, hey, you want to be in the group? He goes, okay. And he could just do it, you know.
Well,
and he was like Jim Carrey. I always said he and Jim Carrey, the only two guys I know of that can, you know, physically change their face and look like the character they're playing without any makeup. I mean, I don't know how the hell you do that, but they can do it. Jim can do it, and Phil could do it, you know. And then he just, you know, and then he became best friends with Paul Rubens and co-wrote Pee Wee's, you know, Big Adventure. And
you were in his audition for SNL, you did the Chick Hazard bit, right? Kind of like when you did it and you had a...
Yeah, he started doing it. And I liked old movies, too. So, sorry, I'm chewing on some candy. I forget. So, we'd always go, you know, just cross that line. You better wish I hadn't. My for 5 cents, I'd... Yeah, what would you do for a nickel? You know, no, for 2 cents, I'd... Yeah, what would you do for a nickel? We would always do that. So, I said, Phil, well, let's write a sketch doing that style. So we wrote that sketch. It was basically my idea, but we wrote it together. It was One More Mission, where I'm like the head of a studio, and he's a B-movie actor doing all these World War II movies, playing a pilot. And I got to fire him because he's gone crazy, because he really thinks he's a pilot, you know. So called One More Mission, and we wrote it together. That was like, he always said his favorite sketch.
It was a great sketch.
But that, you can see us doing that thing back and forth, and... God, he was so funny in it.
Was he just naturally good at everything and confident, and or did you sense like, oh, he's just like the rest of us? He's scared of things and he's insecure.
No, yeah, he was not that confident. He didn't believe in himself. He got offered the show actually, and he turned it down. And then he changed his mind and said yes. So I said, oh, is it because of me? I convinced you to do it, and he's like, no. I thought for sure it was me. He goes, no. I go, oh, what was it? He goes, well. Joel Silver, we did this movie, Jumpin' Jack Flash, and I met Joel Silver. Penny Marshall put me in it, and she goes, I need people that improvise. But I think Phil got the movie on his own anyway.
Yeah.
And then I became friends with Joel, and I kept saying, you got to meet Phil Hartman. This guy's so funny. And so we met. I introduced him to Joel and stuff. So, and we all became friends. So Joel, he said, Joel called me up and said, are you crazy? You got to do it. But he didn't change his mind because of me, but I think if I thought, what did I do? I made him believe in himself, because I thought, well, everyone thought he was amazing, but he didn't. And I go, what do you mean? You're Phil Hartman. You're like amazing. You know, Lauren said, what do you think of Phil Hartman? I said, well, if you think I'm good, I go, you should see Phil Hartman. He's way better than me. He's a genius, you know? And that's how I felt. You know, I said, And Lauren goes, well, how long has he been in the Groundlings? I said, 11 years. He goes, well, John, if he hasn't made it by now, don't you think there's a reason? I said, yeah, I guess. But I thought, well, what could it be? Because how could you be that talented and not, you know? Because in the Groundlings, everyone looked up to him. Even, you know, yes, Tim Stack was one of the main guys I looked up to. And I said, Tim, everyone's good, but wasn't Phil like amazing in improv? Phil, and I go, no offense to you, but wasn't he? He goes, and Tim goes, yeah, it's not offend me, John. He goes, yes, he was on a whole nother level. He was just, and Tim was hilarious. But Phil would say stuff in improvs that you never knew what he was going to say, and it was just hilarious, you know, and just off the wall. So I felt like I kind of made him believe in himself, you know.
That's kind of amazing.
Even though Because I go, how can you not believe? You know, it's like it's you're a sprinter, and Usain Bolt goes, I don't know if I'm that fast. You go, Usain, you're the fastest guy on the team. You're you know, I'm running, you know, 10, and you're running 9.5. I go, you're like way faster than me. I go, what are you talking about? Now I'm on the Olympics. Come on, it's like that. Getting the Olympics, they go, do you know anyone else who can run fast? I go, yeah, my friend Usain Bolt. I go, you think I'm fast? This guy's twice as fast as me. I mean, he's way faster than me. And that's what it was like with Phil. So I'm like, how do you not? And anyway, he did the show, but then he wouldn't write his characters. It was very, he would just do characters, and he could do characters and be a leading man. But for some reason, he didn't do it. And I'd say, why aren't you doing this? Why are you doing Chick Hazard? He did it once. He goes, nah, I'm saving it. I'm going to save it. But like he'd be in his office, I'd walk in, I go, what are you doing? Oh, hi John, I'm reading a magazine on about fly fishing. Just out of the blue. 3 weeks later, I walk in his office, what are you doing? I'm making flies. But like he'd make them perfect, like he'd been making it forever. I go, how do you? And he would just immerse himself in something for like 3 months and like become an expert at it and then get bored and move on to the next thing, you know. And but the nicest guy, you know. You ask anybody ever, from Saturday Night Live to news radio to the Groundlings, everybody loved Phil.
He was one.
And he was that guy. All the women loved him, and all the guys wanted to be, you know, his best friend. He was one of those people. You know?
He was a guy whose death I think people just like the world took really hard. Like even if you didn't know him, because you felt like you knew him, and he certainly. You know, and you loved him. You loved him on The Simpsons and SNL, and anytime he popped up in a movie. And so when it was like, no, how can he not be alive anymore?
Yeah, it was a very, very, very warm person. I think that came across. So yeah, it was the worst thing that ever happened in my life. And I was basically depressed for 5 years after that. I just, because everything I wanted to do with Phil. You know, I go, what about me and Phil? Phil, let's do this. Phil, let's do this. You know, and then finally I was in my driveway. And I went, I'm still alive, you know. And then that's when I started going, I got to do something. I mean, I did not do anything, but I was depressed. So I started doing stand-up, you know. I worked and did stuff, but believe me, I was just not, you know. And I'm still not over it, to be honest. I'll never get over it. It's just the worst thing ever. But, you know, what are you going to do? I'm still alive.
Yeah. And do you appreciate that?
That I'm still alive?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or does every part of you sort of feel like when you got the Tonight Show, where you're like, why get to be the one? Like, does that ever hit you in a weird way?
Oh, yeah. When someone's murdered that you're that close to, and I spoke to other of his friends, it really freaks you out, and you start, it's scary, and you start thinking, am I going to be murdered? Can I just be driving along and poof, I'm gone? Because that's what it's like.
Yeah.
For anybody who loses somebody suddenly, you know, like the Paul Walker, you know, I didn't know the guy, but I feel horrible. I never met the guy, but I see his movies. He's 40 years old. He has a 15-year-old daughter. And just, he wasn't even driving and he's gone.
Yeah.
And he was just doing a charity. That's what makes it worse. You find out he's like this great guy, really charitable, and now he's gone.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh my God. It's the worst because you don't say, you can't prepare for it. You don't get to say goodbye. You don't. It's just the guy's gone. That's it.
Yeah.
So you're in shock, and so it's horrible for anybody who loses someone suddenly like that, whether the murder or an accident. You know, his family. It's like it'll take them. It's awful, and his daughter. You know, it'll take them years to. You know.
Yeah, because I lost my dad a month ago, and it was very sudden. But
sorry.
Oh, that's okay. No. It's good to talk about it because, but I still I feel like it wasn't as horrible as it was. It's not as bad as someone like Phil or Paul or someone who's young where, you know, my dad was 72. And when they, you know, when people start getting into their 70s and 80s, it's sort of like, oh, it's bonus time. You know, it's like, he had a heart attack. Well, that's not, I didn't expect it to happen. But part of your brain goes, well, this kind of happens as people get older.
I lost my dad. He was 70. And I learned a lot about it. And, I learned, because it was out of the blue, and I'm like, oh, man, you know, and I thought, what am I supposed to do? And I just felt lost for like 7 months. And then I was looking at the ocean. It goes, the point of life is to learn everything you can and teach others what you've learned, you know. And I think everything's connected. So I don't think it's a coincidence that we're talking about this and then you just said your dad passed away. I don't know. It's just weird because I always feel like when I learned so much about it that I'm supposed to like help when people talk about you.
Yeah.
I'm supposed to go, okay, well, I have to tell you this.
Yeah.
You know? And all this, I mean, a lot of stuff happened and stuff happened to me that, you know, you could say, well, you imagine whatever, but it's the same stuff that happened to people that have like clinically died and come back.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've had this stuff happen to me and it's just weird. I don't know what it is. And then I read about it in books, you know, but I think there's something else. And I think that, you know, I mean, I guarantee you someone will come to you this and they go, oh, I dreamed about your dad, your father, right?
Yeah.
And he was younger, right? And they go, yeah, how'd you know? They go, I heard his voice. I go, in your right ear? Yeah, how'd you know? You know what I mean? It's always the same.
Stuff, yeah.
They come back younger. He's with, it's like his, and I really think he's with the people that went before and all that. You know, and you could say, well, that's good you think that. Some people believe that, some don't. I do, just some stuff. And I kind of feel like he's, what's beyond our understanding is he, for whatever reason, he learned everything he was supposed to learn, and now he's on to the next thing. And you're still here. We're all here still because we have more to learn.
Sure, sure.
And then once we do, you're taken out.
Well, as like I said, as hard as it is, and I've been kind of going through this weird thing where I've been very forgetful for the past month. Just like really simple things. I'm like, oh, I can't remember this person's name who is a friend of mine. Mm-hmm. And it's just
no,
like
that's
this kind
normal. Of... That's normal because you're kind of in shock and it happens. That happened to me with Phil. My memory, I forgot a lot of stuff.
Well, that's got
to
be that. I mean, that
with Phil, my memory really got. People go, I remember. I go, my memory got fucked up after he died.
I mean, when someone dies a natural death, it's bad enough. But when someone is sort of like ripped away, like Phil or like Paul or like anyone else who's young that doesn't that shouldn't die yet, I would imagine it's even worse because it's like this didn't have to happen. This wasn't supposed to be the thing.
Yeah, and you keep going back. Go, what happened? What happened? And because somehow you think if you can figure out what happened, you can prevent it. You know, and of course you can't, but. I'll tell you a great book. The only thing that helped me was a book, and if you're listening, a friend got me called Many Lives, Many Masters by Brian L. Weiss.
Okay.
So if I were you, I would get that book. And
okay.
It kind of takes you out of your grief, and it's like, grief is, unfortunately, I understand it. It's like very constricting, and it's like you're in the forest. It makes you feel very isolated, and you see the world going on around you, and then you're like, yeah, but don't they know? But you're like in a cocoon of grief. You know, you just feel isolated. So this book, it's like being in the forest and you can't see anything and the trees are 100 feet tall and you're like, where am I? And it's like a helicopter landing and saying, get in. And then the helicopter rises above the trees and way high and then you can see everything 360. And the book makes you feel like, oh, this is all part of this bigger thing that we're all part of. I get it. It makes you feel a little less sad, you know.
Well, that's good. I feel like I have a pretty good, you know, like I get sad, like I was sad last night, and I go, well, I'll just be sad tonight. I'm supposed to be sad now. And then,
that's right. Whenever you feel sad or you cry,
yeah,
you just let it out. The worst thing you could do is not cry when you feel it and hold it in. And the other worst thing you can do is not talk about it. I mean, my family didn't talk about it. I'm like, what the fuck? Hello? Are you going to pretend this didn't just happen?
Yeah.
You know? That's the worst thing because your family or whatever, they're all isolating and you got to call them up and go, let's talk. We need to, you know, it's too big of a deal, you know. It's like, it's your father. It's like the biggest, and then the other thing would be your mother.
Yeah.
So it's too big of a thing to handle alone. So you need to like all support each other and hold each other up and that's how you get through it.
Yeah. And
the other thing I learned is when my mind, sorry.
No, please.
It'll help is I learned you go, well, I said this about Phil after his funeral. I go, well, he may be gone, but he's still my friend. You know, so it's like your dad maybe got, he's still your dad.
Of course.
And then you go, oh, okay. I know, but sometimes you think, oh, he's dead, so that's it. I don't have a dad. No, he's still your dad. And believe me, he's, you know, I still hear my dad and he's still giving me shit.
Or you'll say something and you'll go, oh, that was my dad. Like you'll go, that's something he would have said. Or
yeah, you start acting more like them in the beginning. I'm sure you've done doing stuff because you miss them and you start acting like them. You start talking like them. It's very strange.
Well, I did this weird thing, maybe like a week after a couple weeks after it happened, where I was driving and I just basically started acting out the phone call and imitating my dad, just knowing exactly, because he answered the phone exactly the same way every time, and he asked a lot.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so I kind of had this weird back and forth just out loud by myself, just knowing exactly what he would
say. But
it's
not weird. It's normal that you did that.
Yeah, I think it's fine. Because
the thing you miss most, you usually go, I just want to talk to him one more time, just to have closure. And I say to people, listen, you know the person, you know, like your dad, you know him so well. You could have a full-on conversation. You did it out loud, but in your mind, anything you want to talk about. And all I say is, like, go to, you know, I like going, like, you go to a, like, in Santa Monica in the sun.
Oh, yeah.
You sit on a bench or wherever you like. I don't know. Some spot where you like to just sit and relax and close your eyes. I don't know where that is for you, but wherever that is. And you're alone, and then your mind, you go, okay, let's have a conversation. You go, I want to talk to you about this. And then you'll hear his voice in your mind without forcing it. And you'll have a whole conversation, and it's very weird, but you know exactly what he would say. You don't even have to try to make it up. It'll just be there.
I totally get why that would be great. And I guess...
Yeah, and it makes you, you know... Or you could say, come visit me in my dream tonight, and then they come.
Do you still do that with... Do you still have that sometimes with, like, Phil? And...
Yeah, I've done it, and then they show up.
Oh, that's really cool. I like that.
You could say it's me imagining it, but... You know, all right, I don't care. It's.
I was worried that the dreams would
I'm always aware of it, though, and then I have a conversation and I remember the whole thing. It's not like a regular dream.
I was worried that I would wake up and then the dream, after the dream, and it'd be really sad, like, oh, it's not, he's not here anymore. But I would wake up kind of feeling like, I feel kind of nice. Like, it's not bad.
Have
it's
you
not,
dreamt of him?
Oh, yeah, yeah,
did he
yeah.
look younger?
Well, he did look a bit younger, but yeah. You know, in my dreams,
in
he
his
was
40s, right?
Yeah, some around there.
How'd I know that?
I don't know, because you were there. You've been there.
Yeah, no, I always look younger, and he'll keep getting younger.
Oh, that's weird.
That's what I saw my dad. It was like he was 30 or 29 or something. It was really weird.
Do you talk about it on stage at all, or do you not?
Not really. I don't, because it's not really funny.
I've been talking about it on stage, which it is sort of a dicey. Some parts of it are funny, and then I'm sort of experimenting.
Well, if you can be funny, you know, with it, that's fine. I don't know how it'd be funny.
I mean, it is a challenge, because once you start talking about. You know, people immediately sort of get like, ugh, when you're like, so my dad died, and they immediately go like, ugh, and you have to go, no, it's okay, you know, like, this happens, and it's okay. But it, you know, part of it is it's cathartic for me, and part of it is there's also this sort of comedy challenge of, can I find something about this that's human and relatable, and ultimately, can I make other people feel okay about, like, you know, if they lost someone, or they're gonna lose someone, like... It sucks, but it's okay. This is a part of life, and we can all talk about it. And we don't have to be freaked, you know, too freaked out about it.
Well, I mean, if you can do it, that's great. I wouldn't be good at that on stage, but I do think it's important to talk about because then it makes it less frightening. Because everyone thinks about it, you know, death. I mean,
yeah.
And even if you say you don't, you're like, you're thinking about it all, you know, you just.
Because it's out there, and especially
it's going to happen.
Especially
so,
the older
scary.
You get, the older you get, you're like, man, that's a thing that's going to happen. When you're like 25, you're like, oh, what? This is an endless well of life, you know. And then
everything's going to happen.
You're like, oh shit, I think there's an end point. It's eventually there's. A,
no, I had my roommate, one of my roommates from college, died a couple of years ago, and it was horrible. I'm 56 now; he's 54. It's awful. I can't believe it. That's it just starts happening.
Does it make you less afraid or more? Is it going to freak you out more?
I think both.
Yeah.
It doesn't make me less afraid. No, it freaks me out.
I was actually pretty comforted by the way my dad died. He just had a heart. He was fine, and then he had a heart attack, and he was dead. Like, the idea of decaying freaks me out. The idea of, like... Oh, you're in a hospital for like nine, you know, 6 months.
Well, and that's it. My dad was a doctor, so he'd always say the lucky ones go quick.
Yeah.
So you're right. It was just like, poof.
So what did you take? What was it that?
It's like a quiet fart.
You just made it funny.
See, you could totally make that funny. Yeah. You should write that down. It is. It's a silent.
Don't steal it.
Silent but deadly.
Yeah.
I will not steal it. That is on record that that is your joke.
No, like my dog there. You know, I look at him and I think, God, one day he's going to die and I get sad.
Yeah.
That's why you enjoy him now.
I do.
That's he's a great dog. Jerry's down there under the table. I've heard his, you heard his collar shake a couple times. That's Jerry. Seinfeld. What did you...
Oh, I want some food. Hey, what's the deal with no water on the Nerdist?
Who puts the peanut butter in the Kong toy? This is very specific. Thank you, Kyle. Kyle's like our Jerry. He's a good. We let him out.
Anyway, sorry about your father.
Oh, that's okay. No, I appreciate that, and I don't. You know, and I it's nice to talk about it, and I don't. I feel okay. I mean, I feel as okay as I think you can feel about that. I think I have a weirdly good attitude about it, where I miss him, but I don't, you know, I'm not, every night I'm not like, why, you know, I was like.
Well, he wouldn't want you to be like that.
No.
He didn't want you to suffer. But everyone deals with it in their own way. There's no right way to deal with it. So however anyone deals with it, that's the right way. Except to, you know, I would say kill yourself. That wouldn't be good.
That's not a good way.
They don't want you to be, you know, I mean. I remember my grandmother was like 80 in her 80s, and I said, "Are you afraid to die?" And she's like, "No." I go, "Why not?" She goes, "Oh, it's enough."
Yeah, at a certain point.
Somebody like, they're like, you know, because I guess there's nothing left to do.
Well, my ex-girlfriend's grandmother was like 94, and for the last few years of her life, she would just wake up and be like, "Still?" You know, it was just like, because, you know, at a certain point, you're just old.
Yeah.
And you're just.
Even if you wanted to do more stuff.
There, you can't. Yeah. She just couldn't really do anything else. And she was just as old as you can be. And, you know, it was just like, enough. I got it. Yeah. Enough already. So I think it's okay. And I was lucky that I had a good relationship with him. So it wasn't like, oh, I never got to, like, he knew and I knew how he felt. And so we were very
fortunate
that way. Well,
that's good. Because I remember my friend's dad said, you know, you feel bad because there's like stuff unresolved. Yeah, he goes, there's always stuff. You know, you go, oh, I forgot to say. I mean, it's just, you know.
Yeah.
And then you go, no, it's not about what you didn't say or said. You've said everything.
Yeah.
It's just you miss the person. It's mostly, I think you miss talking to them and hugging them, you know. So you can do that in your mind. And
well, part of your brain can't really compute it. And I think that that's probably just a forever thing where one section of your brain is like, No, he's fine. He's just over, you know, he's sitting in the chair that he always sat.
Well, what I believe is there's people right now in your life that are alive, but you don't see them, but you feel them.
Sure.
You know? And the thing that you feel is you're feeling for them, which to me is energy, which is what love is. So that never goes away. So they're still a part of you, you know, and somehow I think when someone can affect you to the point where you feel them, that just doesn't go away.
Right.
Because you think of them and then you feel them.
Yeah.
Well, what's that, you know? They could be alive and not in the room and you feel them. So that doesn't go away. And
yeah.
You know, maybe there's nothing after this, but who, I don't know. From whose born no traveler returns, puzzles the will, and makes us rather keep those ills we have, then fly to others that we know not of.
Acting?
Thus, conscience doth make cowards of us all. And thus the native hue of resolution is sicklied o'er with the pale cast of thought, and enterprises of great pith and motion. With this regard, their currents turn awry and lose the name of action. Scene. Thank you.
Well, I think that's a lovely place to dismount, because we're at about an hour, 10, actually. That was fantastic. What a lovely conversation.
Thank you, Chris Hardwick.
I'm a huge SNL geek since the beginning, and so just hearing anything, any behind this, you know, all the Phil stuff is really great too. And you know, what was the one thing that you think, or if I'm sure there was more than one, but what do you think you really got take away from Phil? Like, what do you think you learned from him in all that time?
Well, he had a lot of hobbies, and he did a lot of stuff. So he got me to that. Like when he goes, Johnny, you got to get into cars, okay? Johnny, you got to get into golf, okay? So I'm still in the cars and golf, you know, and he introduced me to that. And but I, as far as I don't know. I mean, the one thing I got from him, I mean, I don't know. I really miss him. I mean, if you said, well, are you okay with it now? Are you over it? I'm like, no. It's just always there.
But you're probably okay with the fact that you're not over it, which is a weird sort of...
Well, I don't know how you get over something like that. I just don't think you ever do. I
mean, yeah.
My grandfather is the greatest guy in the world, positive, happy and everything. And he was 22, and he had a brother a couple years older and was killed when he was like 20. Or he was 24, and his brother got killed when he was 26. And he never got over it.
Yeah.
And he was like in his, you know, 78, and he had a picture of his brother. He goes, here's my brother. And then he'd go, and then he'd just start crying.
Oh, man.
Yeah, his brother died like 30 years ago and still just brings it up. And he's like, oh, he'd probably really love this. Any new movie that comes out, he would have loved that movie. It's just as part of him.
Yeah, he just never, I don't think you ever get over it, you know what I mean? I mean, it's not like I walk around depressed or anything. But, you know, sometimes it hits me, you know, it still hits me, and it's just, it just sucks.
It does suck. But it definitely makes you appreciate, it should make you appreciate whatever it is that we have that's not that. Like the good stuff.
I'm not going to even pretend that I know what the hell you're talking about.
I mean, anything that's not... It makes me appreciate, like, the sad parts make me appreciate, like, oh, when things aren't sad, that's really good, because by comparison, this really sucks. So when things are happy, or when I feel good, or when I feel like, oh, I feel okay, you know, like, I really, really go, this is really special, because I could be feeling the other way.
Well, I think it came down to when I was in my driveway, and I'm still alive. I think everyone, you lose somebody, and it's horrible, and then you go, wait, you can't stop living.
Yeah.
You know, and then people go, what do you do? And they go, you gotta go on.
Yeah.
And they'll say, well, why, you know? And after a while, you go like, oh, yeah. And they get it. They go, and then it happens. And then, you know, unfortunately, the more and more people you know that go, it just becomes part of, like, you go, well, all right. And then you just go on. I mean, and then someday it'll be your turn, and then that's it.
Yeah.
So, I try to enjoy my life, like, constantly.
Well, I'm looking forward to...
I learned that.
I'm looking forward to coming to your theater, to your comedy theater on Thursday.
Yes, Thursday at 8 o'clock.
8 o'clock, yeah.
8 p.m. live.
At the John Lovitz Comedy Club and Podcast Theater.
At Universal City Walk.
It's up the escalator from
above
the...
Above Johnny Rockets.
Above Johnny Rockets, yeah.
Wonder what we'll talk about.
I don't know.
Wouldn't it be funny? There's nothing left to talk about.
So just watch John and I stare at each other on stage for an hour.
Oh, what are you?
Well, I'll be interviewing you, Chris Hardwick.
The tables shall be turned. Should I bring this table and then we'll just turn it?
Yes. And then turn it.
I'll turn it.
No, now I do it different. We're doing it on stage and there's like these two couches.
Oh, good.
So if you could be very relaxed. You could eat during the show.
Great.
You get something to eat during the show. And
that's great.
You have a mic and... You could bring a pillow.
What?
Yeah.
Just in case you get a boner.
If you want to be comfortable. We're not on the same couch, for Christ's sake. Lord Jesus. Not trying to seduce you.
Lord Jesus, who you now believe in because you got SNL, so you had to follow that back through.
I believe it. We're all the son of God.
Well, John Lovitz,
I have nothing against Jesus. Are you a Catholic or Christian?
I was raised Catholic.
Yes, you were raised Catholic. I was raised Jewish.
Which I think are very similar.
Which means... not really. Means my as any Jew would say, they're very similar. And any Jewish person would go, my God is your God's dad.
Oh, damn! I guess that's...
Trump!
Damn it! Whoa. Our God's dad's got a kid, and he's fucking back with a vengeance.
Yeah, well, you're always wondering, what happened to Jesus after he was 12? We don't know. Well, I'm going to say he was Jewish, so he was 13. I'm going to say he had a bar mitzvah.
They gave him
he was
some,
a rabbi.
They gave him some shekels. He got some bar mitzvah shekels. They gave him some money for his bar mitzvah, and he got to celebrate.
Or a pen set. A quill and some goat skin.
Or a gift certificate for some moccasins or whatever.
Or an iPod.
Made out of clay. iPod.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Made out of clay.
What if they had that stuff then, and then they just lost the technology?
Jesus totally had that stuff then, because he could have whatever he wanted. He could have had an iPod back
he
then.
He thought he could have made one.
Yeah, he could have made an iPod and then brought it to life and be like, live iPod. And then he would have temporarily created an internet to download the songs on, but just for like a minute.
What if he was alone? He's like, Dad, which is God, he's going to have a television. He's like, not yet. Well, what are we waiting for? Where they're not ready for it.
Are we there yet? Are we there yet? No. Stop bitching
then
at me.
Then you're Jesus, and then you die, and you go up to heaven, and then you see your dad, and you're like, thanks a lot.
Ugh, I don't
way
like you.
Way to protect me.
I'm sending you back.
Way to look over me. Lazarus you bring back from the dead, but me, I'm up here.
You kill me to protect
did
strangers.
Did you send me down for in the first place? I could have just stayed here. Just back where I started. How do you feel, son? Like I've accomplished nothing. Right back where I started. And he goes like, if you keep this crap up, I'll send you back. That's why I sent you down in the first place.
You don't understand me.
And God goes, oh, for Christ's sake. He was Jewish, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Really Jewish.
Super Jewish?
Crazy Jewish. He was a rabbi.
He was lousy with Judaism.
Which means he was a teacher. They didn't have the Christian religion then. They were Jewish. They were Roman or Jewish.
Yeah, Christians were hipster Jews.
They weren't Roman Catholics because that was based on him.
That's right.
They were Roman and they were Jewish. Had a bar mitzvah.
Then what happened?
No. Well, they say they don't know. I mean, come on. It's like saying, you know, it's like saying a baseball player. Well, he's in high school and now he's in the major leagues. Well, what happened in between for 7 years?
Rumspringer.
He got drafted.
They should just look at his blogs and see what he was doing. Oh, so just check his Twitter feed. See what he's doing. Eating fish. Eating fish. Eating fish.
He slept next to a prostitute every night, but they never had sex. No, we're just friends. Imagine if you're Jesus. He's like, thanks, Mary. Everybody but me. Jesus, guess who I slept with last night? Who? Your best friend. All right. Fine. What about me? No, we're just friends. You're a prostitute. Come on. Nope. You won't respect me.
But...
Oh, somebody's calling.
What?
I wonder if they're calling me live, like going, how can you say that?
Well, we're not on live. Oh. But that'd be really amazing if they...
We are on live. We're streaming my show live.
We're going to stream on Thursday night, right?
Yes.
We're going to stream.
Stream.
We're not streaming.
And I am proud to announce, unbeknownst to Chris Hardwick, he's coming on the John Lovitz Comedy Network to do shows in the studio that will be on camera. So he'll continue to do this, and he's going to do live shows on camera.
What?
Oh, you didn't know?
Oh, it's nice to know. I'm going to find out.
How awkward.
Well, that's weird. Lorraine Newman called me earlier and said, you got it. And I'm like, what did I get? I didn't know.
Well, you can do that. It's an invitation, but... It would be awkward for you to now say no.
Damn you, Lovitz!
Then you see it, you go like, oh, well, this is really nice.
It's a nice space over there. I like that theater. It's nice.
Did you see the podcast studio?
I've seen it all, yeah. I was there with Rob Paulsen a couple, like 2 months ago.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
With Robbie Paulsen and...
on stage?
Yeah, yeah. I did Talking Tunes with Rob Paulsen. It was fun.
Do you do voice? Do you mm-hmm. do cartoon voices?
I do. That's how I know Rob, yeah. Yeah, we worked together for like 3 years.
I'm going to have to do some research on you.
Just research everything that happened after 2007.
Why do you hate the Jews?
I don't hate them.
Mixed feelings. Is it because they put you in awkward situations, like they'll say, oh, thank you for doing this? And you're like, I never said I would do that. You just said it, and it's very awkward now.
If I had to boil it down, it would be that, yes. If I boiled down all of Judaism into that, I think it would be that. We said this, and now you awkwardly can't say no to this.
Yes. Does this comic book store know you're leaving?
And coming to the John Lovitz?
Who said I was leaving? Stop it! That's what I hate about the Jew.
They all do that to you. Well, thank you for being here, John Lovitz. I will see you on Thursday night.
Thank you, Chris. An honor to be on your show.
Enjoy your burrito,
everyone.
The number
one show, Comedy iTunes. Oh, American Life. Yeah, but a lot of times it's not.
Sometimes it's Night Vale. Sometimes
I've seen it. It says you.
Sometimes it's us. Sometimes it's Marin. Sometimes it's Rogan. Sometimes it's Corolla. Sometimes it's Kevin.
Yeah, it keeps switching around.
Yeah, we flop around. We flop around. I'm just happy to be nominated. I'm just happy to be in the group.
How many people listen to this show? This isn't live, so you can snip all this out, right?
It's a few hundred thousand.
Each show?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I just want to mention then, on Fund Anything, we're trying to raise money to help unknown comics. Go fundanything.com, and you'll see it says John Lovitz.
We should include that. What are you raising? You're raising money for comics?
Yeah, to do like specials and, you know, and help them do podcasts and different
stuff. That's
great. Stuff. Yeah.
100% support that.
Find new talent.
Fund Anything. Search for John Lovitz.
.com. Might say campaign over, but you can still give money.
Don't you listen to the website. You just fucking give your money anyway. If that website tells you otherwise.
But you get rewards. It's not like you just give me money and then you go, what do I get? I go, you know, I could do your voice message, your outgoing voice message,
yep.
Or acting class. You know, there's different rewards. You get something for the money.
That's cool.
Yeah.
We support that. Fundanything.com. John Lovitz. Right.
Oh, God, there's just nothing left to talk about.
Do you want to just awkwardly sit here for 10 seconds?
Well, I have a question.
Okay.
On my right is Jonah. Do you ever introduce him or mention him, or you just say sit there and fill in the dead spots?
Jonah. There were none, so.
There Jonah. Dead spots. Jonah passed away 10 years ago this very night.
I'm a hologram.
Ooh.
No, I talk more usually, but what you were saying was interesting.
I know, I kind of yap a lot.
No,
are you
should.
Are you and
yep.
Jonah a comedy team?
No, we're friends, and there's usually a third guy on the show, but he is writing on my television show, so he was not able to be here. But Jonah and I have been friends for ages.
Kind of a guy that usually throws in jokes, but when, you know, a couple dudes are talking about dead dads, hard to fucking fit one in.
No, you better up your game, bitch.
But you said you talk about it on stage.
I do talk about it on stage. He doesn't talk about it on stage.
I can't.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, if only.
No.
What do you say? You go, so my dad died?
I do.
No, you can laugh.
I do, actually. I do. And then I talk about, mainly I've been talking about how ridiculous funerals are and how insanely expensive funerals are. And then I had already weirdly been writing a bunch of stuff about my dad anyway, like months before he died.
What did he do for work?
My dad was a professional bowler. He was an ex-professional bowler. And he owned a bowling alley in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
oh,
my dad's
wow.
like a Hall of Fame professional bowler, so he
what
retired.
What's his name?
Billy Hardwick. So he retired in the early 70s, mid-70s.
Oh, you know, I used to watch it. Who was the...
Dick Weber.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So he was, like, in that
yeah.
group?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
really?
Dick was my dad's mentor. Dick was older, a bit older. Dick died, of, I don't know, a handful of years ago, but maybe like 6-7 years ago. And that was my childhood. Was growing up on the Pro Bowlers tour.
And did you? So do you bowl?
Uh huh.
We're gonna save this for my show.
We can talk
this
about
has become
bowling.
The pre-interview for the show,
which is fine. Yeah, yeah, this is good. This
Why
is good.
Do you hate the Jewish bowler?
There aren't
Chris
any.
Hardwick.
There aren't any to hate. There was one guy, Larry Lichtstein. He was a Jewish bowler. I knew him, Larry Lichtstein.
There's a reason there aren't any.
Right.
Because if you went to you're Jewish, you went to your parents, I want to be a professional bowler. They're like, don't even think about it. Don't ever mention it again. I don't want to hear this nonsense. No. Not an option. No. End of discussion.
It'd be like the movie The Jazz Singer with Neil Diamond, but with bowling instead of pop music.
Well, you know, The Jazz Singer with Neil Diamond was based on a movie on the first talkie called The Jazz Singer starring Al Jolson in 1927.
Right. Yeah.
I used to imitate him. I saw that Larry Parks, as an actor, played the Al Jolson story. But that Al Jolson was such a big superstar that the first talking movie, the movie was about him, his life. Can you imagine?
That's incredible. It was and he played himself.
And he played himself. And his dad wanted him to be a cantor, and you sing all the religious songs at temple. And he's like, "But I want to be on Broadway," and it was true.
Krusty the Clown. It was basically the Krusty the Clown story, Herschel Krestovsky, where his dad wanted him to be a rabbi.
Yeah.
And he's the same story.
And he said, "I want to be a clown."
We didn't even talk about The Critic.
We didn't talk about.
God damn it!
Good show.
Great show. Fucking great show.
Well, I can come back.
No, this was it. No, you can come back for
Heading
sure.
Heading into hour four of the John Lovitz episode.
You should. God damn it!
I know. How long? You said it's an hour.
It's been an hour or 30.
Are you gonna edit it?
Probably not. But please come back, and because then we can slobber all over you about The Critic, which was a great, great, great show.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. And I will see you Thursday night.
Thank you, Chris Hardwick.
John Lovitz, good to see you.
Thank you, Jonah.
Thank you, John.
And thank you to Jerry, my dog.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.